From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Presently, there are potential plans to build as many as 20 desalination plants across the state of California, and there are two measures on the ballot in Marin County in the North Bay, measures S and T, that address the question of whether or not to move ahead with desalination. Desalination is the process that removes excess salt and other minerals from water and turns saline water into fresh water. We'll discuss the measures and desalination next. Forum is up ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Many counties throughout California face potential water shortages, and there are plans in the works to build as many as 20 desalination plants across the state, a process that converts seawater into drinking water. Desalination is a means to deal with drought and water emergencies, and implementation would create a bigger supply of usable water, but it is expensive and it raises a number of environmental concerns. The Bay Area's four largest water agencies, the East Bay Municipal Utility District, the Santa Clara Valley Water District, the Contra Costa Water District, and the San Francisco PUC, are all exploring desalination, and two desalination measures will be on the ballot in next week's election for Marin County voters to decide on. Joining us for a discussion about those measures in Marin and the pros and cons of desalination this hour are Paul Heliker, who is general manager of the Marin Municipal Water District. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us in studio is Heather Cooley, co-director of the Water Program with the Pacific Institute, and they've released a major study on desalination. Good morning, Heather Cooley.
Good morning.
Also say good morning to Adam Scow, who is California Campaign Director for Food and Water Watch. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And Paul Rogers joins us by phone this morning, environmental reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and managing editor of Quest, KQED's Science and Environment series. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, Michael.
Hi. Glad to have you all aboard. And I'm going to begin, if I may, with you, Paul Heliker, just so we can get kind of a broad sketch of what we're talking about with these two measures since it all began with the Marin Municipal Water District, didn't it?
Well, in some ways, yes. MMWD was looking at desalination as an alternative, but we put it on hold in April because of the fact that our demand has down so much. So at this point, MMWD doesn't have any plans to move forward with desalination. But as you mentioned, there are two ballot measures on the ballot, which I can describe if you'd like.
Yeah, let's hear about S&T because one is in response to the other, and I'd just like listeners to know what we're talking about here.
Right. Both measures deal with the question about whether or not voters should have approval of a desalination facility. And they both say that before MMWD can move forward with a desalination facility, either financing or building it, that we would need to seek the approval of voters. And that's the basic information in Measure S. Measure T goes further. It says that before...
That was the one that got 18,000 signatures, right? All the signatures to get on the ballot, right?
Yeah, T was an initiative that was started back in January, brought to the board with the signatures in June. And both that measure and Measure S were put on the ballot by the board in July. Measure T, as I was saying, goes further, and it says that before MMWD spends any further money on desalination, either planning or analysis, that we need to seek approval of the voters. And so that's the basic difference between the two.
A pretty clear cut, but water demand dropped in Marin in the last year and a half by about 15%, didn't it?
Yeah, we're not unique. Demand has dropped all over the country, and in California in particular. And I think it's related heavily to the recession, but also our conservation program has been fairly robust. We've tripled our conservation program expenditures in the past 5 years, and I think it's having an effect.
And what's your sense of how the voters look at desalination in Marin? I mean, overall.
We took a poll last year and found that between 58 and 70% of the voters supported desalination, and there was a group of about 25% who opposed it. We haven't done a poll since then, but at this point, it's really kind of irrelevant because desalination has been taken off the table and won't come back on the table unless there's some change in circumstances.
So let's talk generally about desalination. Now, Heather Cooley, and again, Heather Cooley co-directs the water program for Pacific Institute. And as I said, they did a pretty exhaustive study, advantages, disadvantages, try to be unbiased about it. And let's sort of assess, if we can, from you. What did the report tell us? What does the report tell us?
Okay. Well, the report looks at some of the advantages and disadvantages of seawater desalination. And there are certainly some very important advantages. Seawater desalination is a reliable source of water, and it's independent of weather conditions. And so if there's no matter if there's a drought or a wet year, we are able to produce a set amount of water. And that can be an important advantage for water systems whose other sources may be very vulnerable to drought. It also produces a very high quality water. And that can be particularly beneficial if you're in an area where there are lower quality sources available. You may be able to mix it. And it also provides a water source that is under local control, which can be also very beneficial.
All the pluses.
Right. Correct.
But it is expensive, as I said earlier.
That's certainly correct. It is expensive. It's one of them. It's far more expensive typically than many water supply options, and more expensive than water conservation and efficiency. Again, the price is variable. It's hard to say. It's hard to give one single value for the price. It's very dependent on local conditions, but it typically is quite expensive. It's also very energy intensive. And so, those communities that are concerned about greenhouse gas emissions, that are trying to reduce those, that can be problematic. And that's also, one of the major reasons it is so expensive. Because it's energy intensive, it also the price is vulnerable to the price of energy. And there is indication that the price of energy is going up. And so that could suggest that the price of desalination may also go up in the future.
Adam Scott, there's also concern. I mean, the Sierra Club has talked about this, about killing marine life, and not a tremendous use of energy. I think the Sierra Club said it could actually double the energy use and the high cost, but also leftover brine.
Absolutely. And this proposed plant, Marin, first I should say, last year the Water Board approved a 5 million gallon per day facility right by the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge in San Rafael. That area is an area of restoration, actually, in the bay now. We're seeing eelgrass restoration, 300,000 native oysters, a place for salmon to spawn. This is a place that is particularly important to ecological restoration after a long legacy of pollution in the bay. And we feel that that has not been adequately addressed yet in terms of desalination's impacts on that area. Also, yes, there is the brine. There's also a toxic sludge that is created through the desalination process that's going to be dumped in a landfill near Nevada, which is actually in a wetlands. And also the brine going back into the bay, increasing the salinity and potentially impacting the acidity and the pH balance.
It would be your argument that Marin could do a lot of good just with conservation, I suppose. And the notion is that you got 55 inches of rain a year there in Marin, and seven reservoirs, two of which aren't being used. So the assumption is we don't need a desalination plant?
Not at this point, and I think we all agree about that, it sounds like. Marin has a beautiful watershed. I encourage all the listeners to go revisit it because it is so beautiful, the five, six reservoirs, the seventh reservoir that is not in use in case of drought. Because of desalination's negative environmental impacts and financial impacts, it really needs to be the option of last resort, no question. And when we see opportunities in Marin to make the water use more efficient, to encourage wise water use with irrigation, replacing inefficient toilets and efficient washing machines, giving people new incentives to implement the new gray water code. The state has relaxed gray water standards. There's a lot of interest for that in Marin, also rainwater harvesting. I think all of those things, which come at a much lower cost to people's rates and to the environment, should be prioritized. Marin has done a little bit about that. Unfortunately, recently they cut basic conservation programs, eliminating rebates for washing machines and toilets. Unfortunately, that's a step backwards. We need to think that those need to be reinstated and to take that further.
Let me go to you on this, Paul Halliker, because I notice Jared Hoffman said desalination is the ultimate drought proofer, and these arguments that you hear, particularly about the environment, you say what?
Well, we did an environmental impact report, and ironically, the supporters of Measure T have sued us, claiming that it's not adequate, but we think it's quite adequate, and that lawsuit will be decided come this fall. But it covered everything that we're talking about. It looked at the impact on the marine life in the bay, found that the impacts were insignificant, looking at three different ways of analyzing what the impacts would be, and it would be designed so that there would be such low velocity coming through the plant that anything that could swim away could. On the brine, it was actually going to be an environmental benefit because it would be mixed with the wastewater from the Central Marin Sanitation Agency, and so that water would then come out at the same salinity as the bay. And on energy use, that is an issue, but we planned to be able to meet that with renewable power. So if the desal plant ever goes forward in the future, it, I think, has been well covered on the environment. We only found two significant impacts. One was construction noise while the project would be built. And then the second one is we'd need to put tanks up to be able to store the water from the desalination plant. And one would be on a ridge where it would be hard for us to screen it visually. So those were the only impacts we identified.
Wouldn't there be impact, though? I mean, because we've talked about desalination being expensive, especially in these difficult times. You've got leaky pipes, you've got infrastructure. In other words, these would kind of take a back seat, wouldn't they, as far as how much money you could spend?
No, not at all. It would be over time, if the desalination plant ever came back on the table and the board decided to move forward with it, it would be financed with debt, and that debt would be paid off over time. And the estimate is that the total amount of cost that would be incurred by the district during that time frame of paying off the debt and operating the plant would generate about a 10% increase in cost. So we'd be looking at a total maximum of maybe 10% increases in rates if we ever went forward with the desalination plant. So that's, we think, a relatively small amount of money to pay for drought-proof supply if we have to actually go forward with it.
And Heather Cooley, what did the Pacific Institute find out about this kind of, logjam that we've come to here in terms of the debate?
Well, I think as we mentioned, seawater desalination is expensive, and it certainly will increase costs. It does so at a benefit of reliability, and that's certainly something in Marin they're concerned about. I think it's important to look at all of the options that are available, not just to focus on one technology or one water source, but to compare that with recycled water, conservation and efficiency, and other sorts of supply options. And to then base your decision on that. Are there other options available to provide that same degree of reliability other than seawater desalination? Could it be done at lower costs and with fewer environmental impacts?
And again, Heather Cooley is co-director of the Water Program for the Pacific Institute. Paul Rogers is environment reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. He's also managing editor of Quest, KQED's Science and Environment series. Paul, let's get your take on all this. I mean, I think when we look at desalination and people are looking at it all across the state, there are benefits, clearly, but there are costs, and costs to the environment, too.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because people were really getting excited about desalination a year or two ago. Remember, we were in the third year of a drought. We were actually in the worst drought in 20 years since the late 1980s, early 1990s. But then it rained a whole lot in the last winter. So most rainfall around the Bay Area was about 110-120% of normal. You don't hear people usually wanting to spend money on expensive water sources when it's raining. That's one of the reasons why the statewide water bond was pulled off the ballot, the $11 billion measure that Governor Schwarzenegger was hoping to push for new dams and a whole bunch of other projects, because when people's lawns are green, they don't want to vote for money for new projects. But, you know, that being said, desalination is coming to California. A lot of parts of California have far shakier water systems than Marin. Marin, as you mentioned, gets a lot of rain. But there are places in Southern California, San Diego, for example, that rely very heavily on very tenuous water supplies, like the Colorado River or the Delta. And, you know, those water supplies aren't that reliable at this point. And so basically they are building a big plant right now in Carlsbad, 35 miles north of San Diego. The plant should be done in 2012, and it's going to be the largest one in North America. And I think people all over the Bay Area who are looking at desal are not going to do anything until they see how well this Carlsbad plant works out.
Couldn't the cost, which is obviously tied to energy, as has been said a couple times here, go down if surface and groundwater supplies decline more and prices jump?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of variables, and there's a lot of different ways to get energy. I mean, one of the newer plants that a lot of people look at around the world is in Perth, Australia. They have a plant that opened in 2006. It would be... it provides something like 20% of the city's water needs. And remember, Perth is a city that's twice the size of San Francisco. It's 1.7 million people. That plant is powered by a wind farm. Japan has desalination plants that are powered by nuclear power. The plant down in Carlsbad is going to have a lot of solar on it. Also, when you look at energy use, for example, in Southern California, it takes an incredible amount of energy to pump water from the north all the way down through the state and federal water projects. So you have to factor in the fact that you won't be using that electricity to pump water thousands or hundreds of miles south.
What about climate change and what about threat to wildlife? I mean, there are high stakes, as many people see it, with respect to desalination on those scores.
Well, I think the main environmental objection, when you really take time to talk to environmentalists, is growth. A lot of places in California have had their growth limited by a limited water supply. And if you look at California, a lot of the state's major cities, including San Jose and Los Angeles, get 15 inches of rain a year. That's the same amount of rain as Morocco gets, same amount as Casablanca every year. And so, you know, if we didn't have this massive system of dams and canals and aqueducts and pumps, we would basically be Wyoming. We would be making cow chips and not computer chips, and we wouldn't be able to sustain the population that we have. So, you know, we've always had water difficulties in California, and like I said, I think you're going to see, particularly the next time we have an extended drought, or if we have levees breaking in the delta and an earthquake, you're going to see a rush to these kind of plants. And frankly, for a lot of people at that point, the cost doesn't matter because, you know, water is something that you can't live without.
There is still a lot of confusion, in the press about these two measures that are on the ballot in Marin. How do you see them, Paul, in terms of their ultimate effect or what they mean for Marin voters?
I think they're interesting for the rest of the state. I mean, it is worth noting that, you know, Measure S, which is the measure that was put on by the Water District, is actually supported by a number of environmental groups, including the Marin Audubon Society, the Marin Conservation League, supported by the League of Women Voters. You know, I don't know which one of those two measures is going to pass, but
I think T is supported by the Republican Party and the Green Party, isn't it?
And the Democratic Party. So it's a real. The politics are fascinating. I tell you one thing though. You mentioned this other plant that the five largest water agencies in the Bay Area, San Francisco, East Bay Mud, you know, Contra Costa, Zone 7, and Santa Clara are looking at building over in Contra Costa County near Pittsburgh. If the Marin measure, the tougher one, succeeds, I think that you're going to see opponents on many of these around the state putting similar measures. And, you know, oftentimes these kind of measures can kill projects. Look at the project that SFO had to build runways into the bay 10 years ago. As soon as San Francisco voters said that San Francisco Airport couldn't build new runways without a vote of the people, that was the end of the project.
Paul Rogers, again, is environmental reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and also managing editor of Quest, KQED's Science and Environment series. And Adam Scow is California campaign director for Food and Water Watch. Since so much depends on conservation, if you're not going to go the desalination route, I'd like to talk to you a bit more about that, Adam, because there's talk about stormwater reuse and water recycling. I mean, there are a lot of things that obviously could be done, theoretically, if you could get the support. And you were also talking about fixing pipeline leaks, as I alluded to before. You talked about toilets and laundries and so forth. I mean, you really got to get sort of a populist movement here in some ways, don't you?
And that's emerging in Marin. This is one of the great things about the movement behind Measure T that collected 18,000 signatures from local Marin voters to put this question on the ballot. Really, the impetus behind it is that they want the district to be a partner in these more cost-effective, environmentally friendly measures, and they haven't been getting that yet. What we've seen is a lot of money and a lot of time pushed into a big centralized project that's enormously expensive. We're talking $100 million just for a construction cost. Once you look at bond repayment, energy use, inflation, we're looking at $400 million over 20, 30 years. So one thing that's really important to understand is that there's trade-offs. In the era of limited budgets, we can only spend so much money. Are we going to spend it on prioritizing the other things that we know work, fixing leaks, encouraging conservation, or are we going to spend it on massive centralized projects, putting ourselves more in debt? Paul mentioned water use is going down in Marin. That's a good thing. The district should work with that to keep water use low. That's good for the environment. It could be good for ratepayers. Currently, ratepayers are being penalized for using less water. We've seen rates go up about 30% over the last few years, while water use has declined 15%. We need to get those incentives fixed so people are rewarded for using less water instead of penalized. If I can say a word about Measure T, A Measure T is the ballot measure that requires a vote of the public before the water district implements a plant in San Rafael. And when I say implement, I mean getting permits from state and local agencies, designing the plant, engineering the plant, setting up the plant. All those things could add up to millions of dollars. Measure S is a big loophole that allows all that money to be spent, and the project might not ever be approved. So we're saying let's have the vote before we spend people's money. Measure T is that measure.
Heather Cooley, the Pacific Institute report, which, by the way, is an impartial report, downloaded over 400,000 times, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
It sort of says this is all technology. It's not ideology. I mean, and some people kind of confuse the two, I think, don't they?
That's correct. It certainly is a technology that is successful in parts of the world.
Well, Australia is a good example.
Australia is a great example. About half of the global desalination capacity is located in the Middle East. For some nations, particularly small island nations, it is a very important source for them. So it's certainly something that we can do. Our feeling and my feeling is that really it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when and how. When have we exhausted the other alternatives, the other cheaper alternatives, more environmentally friendly alternatives? And once we've decided that it's appropriate to build desalination, how do we build it? How do we power these systems? Do we use renewable technologies? What kind of intake structures do we use? How do we dilute the brine? Those are the type of questions I think we need to grapple with.
And how do we get the money?
Certainly that is a big issue. I think, and Paul had mentioned this, there is a threat. Back in 1992, Santa Barbara did build a plant in response to the drought, the last extended drought we had from 87 to 92. The plant operated successfully, but as soon as the plant was completed, it started to rain, and the plant was put into standby mode and was never used. And the ratepayers there are continuing to pay that. So there is a concern of building these plants too soon. It does create a tremendous cost and stranded infrastructure, frankly.
Well, let me do this. Many of you, of course, are interested in this whole subject of desalination, and it may be inevitable, but there's a lot of controversy now, and we're trying to not only talk about it generically, but also look at what's going on in Marin County. Let me just review. Measure S, which was placed on the ballot by the District Water Board, would require a vote of the public before the district could proceed with construction of a desalination plant in Marin. It still allows the Water District to plan for the technology, and our guest Paul Heliker from the Marin Water District supports this. Measure T is an initiative placed on the ballot by desalination critics. It's similar to Measure S in that it also would require a vote of the public to proceed with construction of desalination, but it differs in that it would prohibit the district from approving any contracts relating to planning or building a plant. Our guest Adam Scow supports this. You may support one or the other, and you may want to join us, or you may simply have questions or comments. If you'd like to join the conversation, we welcome your participation. Our toll-free number is available to you, and you can call us now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, your toll-free number for joining the conversation, 866-733-6786. Talking about desalination plants possibly in Marin County's future, but talking also about desalination plants probably in California's future as well. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, and you can also join us by going to our website and posting your question or comment, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. Our guests include Paul Heliker, the General Manager of Marin Municipal Water District, Adam Scow, California Campaign Director of Food and Water Watch, Heather Cooley, who is co-director of the Water Program with the Pacific Institute, and Paul Rogers, Environment Reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and Managing Editor at Quest. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about two ballot measures that Marin County voters will decide upon having to do with the possibility of a desalination plant in Marin County's future. There are two measures on the ballot that address that question, but Marin is not by any means the only county in California faced with a potential shortage of fresh water, and we're exploring the economic and environmental costs and benefits of converting seawater into drinking water. With us in studio is Heather Cooley, who co-directs the Water Program for the Pacific Institute. And by the way, you can read that report online simply by going to their website, www.pacinst.org. We've also had Adam Scow with us, who is California Campaign Director for the Food and Water Watch, and Paul Heliker here in studio as well as General Manager of the Marin Municipal Water District. And Paul Rogers with us by phone, Environment Reporter with the San Jose Mercury News and Managing Editor of our Science and Environmental series, Quest. Let's go to your phone calls, and we'll begin with a caller from San Rafael. Matt, good morning.
Good morning. My name is Matt Butler. I'm in Shannonfeld. My question is, if a desalination plant were located near the Richmond-Shannonfeld Bridge, how would we remove all the contaminants from the urban runoff? I mean, I understand 40,000 square miles of California drain into the bay through Cartina Strait. So we've got industrial, agricultural, urban runoff. The bay has PCBs, DDT, chlordane, and mercury in it. I'd be more concerned about those than the salt. How are we going to remove that from drinking water?
Okay. Paul Halliker?
Well, the good thing about desalination, reverse osmosis, is that it is the technology that's used to produce the purest water in the world. It's used in all kinds of processes that require very, very pure water. So the desalination facility that we evaluated and did the environmental impact report on and the pilot plant on was able to remove any of the contaminants that were in the bay, and we found actually not very many and at very low levels. It's all in our environmental impact report. So the water that came out of there, we sampled for more than 600 contaminants and found none of them. So the technology, I think, is a very robust, very well-demonstrated technology. Water quality from the desalination plant was actually better than the water quality that we produced from our other reservoirs. So if we ever had to do a desalination plant, I think people can rest assured that it would be a high-quality source of water.
Well, we'll hear from Adam Scow on this, but I'm looking at an email from a listener named Armin in Oakland who says, does desalination remove any important needed minerals?
Well, the only thing you get out of desalination is water, H2O. And in order to make the water palatable, if you've ever had distilled water, you know it doesn't taste very good. But in order to make it palatable and to keep it from corroding our pipes and to make it similar in taste to the rest of our water supplies, we'd have to add back in minerals such as calcium and a little bit of sulfate and so on. And all of those are naturally occurring. They occur in our existing water, and that's what makes water taste good.
Adam, you concerned about the purity of the water?
I think it's a good question from the caller. Certainly many citizens who have been tracking this plant are quite concerned about water quality. Certainly the bay does have a toxic legacy, and we know that from recent examples of desalination, these membranes are subject to failure. They often break. They need to be replaced, adding to the overall cost of the project. The best example of that is in Tampa Bay, Florida, where the thing was 4 years late, constantly being repaired. I think probably something could be shut off if something were to get through the membrane, but this is a legitimate concern. Also, we need to look at our federal agencies, the EPA, is just starting to take a hard look at toxics at the parts per trillion level. They've been behind on those studies. I think we need independent studies to confirm the safety.
Heather Cooley, weigh in here.
Yes, generally, Paul is correct. It is a very robust technology capable of removing all sorts of contaminants from water and producing a very high quality water. Membranes do fail. They do go bad. That generally, the water agency does monitor that, and there are no kind of major threats. In Tampa Bay, it was a slightly different issue where they located the plant. They chose to locate it in a plant that had a lower overall salt concentration, but it was a much more variable quality. So they had some pretreatment issues. It was nothing that ever got to the customer. It's something that they have worked out. That plant certainly was 5 years late, but it wasn't a result of any kind of failure of the reverse osmosis system.
And, Paul, are you pretty confident about this robust technology and it's making our water pure?
Sure. I mean, this is very measurable. You look at what goes in the front end, and you look at what comes out the back end, and you can measure it. I mean, the numbers are the numbers. California has the strictest drinking water laws in the United States, and if the numbers meet those laws, they meet those laws. I think that the important thing to realize is there are about 15,000 desalination plants already operating around the world, as people have said. They're in Spain, they're in Australia, they're in Israel. I mean, this isn't something radically new that California would be trying. In fact, the United States is behind a lot of the rest of the world on this. I don't think that the drinking water quality is much of an issue. Any of these issues about parts per trillion and pharmaceuticals and other emerging contaminants are usually going to be in other water supplies as well, whether it's water you're getting from a river, water you're getting from a lake, water you're getting from the ground. I think the real sticking point here is basically going to come down to cost. How much do people want to pay for their water? Are there cheaper ways to get it? How long and extreme is the drought? Can you get water from farmers? Because it's really important to remember in California that farmers use 80% of the water, and they contribute about 7 or 8% of the state's GDP. So we have a lot of places where farmers are not using canals lined with clay, or farmers are not using drip irrigation. And in the end, the solution to California's water supplies, a lot of it, I believe, is going to be cities paying farmers to put in conservation measures and then buying the extra water.
All that agricultural use of water notwithstanding, wondering what your response is to this listener, Craig, who sends in the following email. I was assistant manager of a water system, and if we did an EIR on a desalination plant, because of the cost of construction and enormous energy costs, plus the environmental problem of disposal of the waste brine, wouldn't it be much cheaper to prohibit the planting of any lawns within the district and gain supplies that way, or reuse wastewater like they're doing in Orange County, or buying out Russian River and Sacramento River agriculture water rights like the federal government has been doing in the San Joaquin Valley?
Absolutely, but both of those things are really politically difficult. You can tell people in California they're not going to have a lawn, but enforcing it gets pretty tough. And I think that's a great idea, because lawns use 50% or more of the water during the summer months. The question about recycled water is a great one, too. The Santa Clara Valley Water District already has been doing recycled water for about 5% of its supply for 10 years. There's 100 miles of purple pipe running through Silicon Valley that takes treated wastewater and waters golf courses and you know, highway medians with it. But when you really start expanding it, people start yelling toilet to tap, and you know, even though the science is very clear on that, too, both of those things are maybe politically more difficult than building a desal plant. But I think the guest earlier from Food and Water Watch who said that conservation is in the end cheaper, that's probably going to be the prevailing mode in the next decade in the Bay Area, unless there's a really extreme drought, because there's a lot of water still sort of left on the table at $100 an acre foot that you can get through better conservation practices. And this desal is $500 to $1,000 an acre foot.
Well, here's David Adamskow in Berkeley, who says, could the brine not be used to make top quality sea salt that could be sold to subsidize the operation?
I'm not sure about that. I would pass that question to Heather, the expert on desalination.
Well, generally, it would require a kind of a large land area to do that, and that could actually increase the cost. The cheaper option is typically to dispose of it in the ocean, either directly or mixing with wastewater, as Marin's pursuing.
Before we go to more of your calls, Paul Heliker, here's another listener in Berkeley who says, will desalination provide an additional source of water after a large earthquake damages larger water delivery systems? If so, at this point, it should be emphasized as a public safety measure.
That's a very good point. Desalination would be a reliable source for a variety of reasons, and it would be a plant that would be located in an area that we don't have a lot of easy supply access to. So that is one thing to think about. And if I could just take a minute and talk about the cost that we've been talking about here. The cost of expanding our recycled water system is twice that of putting in a desalination plant. And we've been a leader in Marin. We have more different uses of recycled water than anywhere else in the state. We use it for car washes, for cooling towers, for, of course, for irrigation. And if we could expand the system cost effectively, we would, and we're looking at one small increment to that. And then on conservation, some of the techniques we've talked about are more cost effective, and that's why we've put money into them. We spent more money on conservation by a factor of 3 over the past 5 to 6 years than we spent on desalination. So that's where our focus is, and we expect that that's going to return benefits in the future. But some types of the conservation techniques that people are talking about, rainwater catchment, for example, is much more expensive. It's about 3 times the cost as a desalination facility. So when it comes down to how do we use our ratepayer dollars most cost effectively, the district has a responsibility to make sure it puts its money into the most effective solution. And so that's the challenge we face. Desal is obviously one alternative. It's one that is a last resort that the district is looking at. But the problem with Measure T is that it takes it off the table.
Let me go to more calls. And we go to Larkspur. Michael, you're on.
Hello. Yes, I understand that the state prison is the largest user of water by far. You're talking about conservation. I'm wondering what they're doing about the protest that the prisoners do when they protest by flushing their toilets using millions of gallons of water, using their old-style high-volume flush toilets. So before going to, you know, expensive results, why can't we put some kind of limitation on the water that they use, or at least replace their toilets?
Adam Scott, you want to weigh in here?
Absolutely. I agree with the caller 100%. There are enormous opportunities to reduce and make the water use more efficient at San Quentin Prison. And all across Marin, Paul Rogers made that point. I think he's right. It's still 3 to 4 times more cost effective than desalination. There's lots of water waste in Marin County, particularly around irrigation. It's over a third of the water use. And the district itself admits that there's overuse of water. You can see it driving around. You can see water irrigating sidewalk and cement and roads.
During the drought, there was a serious people were not flushing the toilets. I mean, they were, you know, managing to do that, and there was an amazing saving of water a number of years ago in Marin. Let me thank the caller, and let's go to more of your calls. We'll go to San Anselmo. Peter, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Michael. Something I want to point out, the difference between the two ballot measures. Measure T requires a vote before any contracts are signed, any contracts for construction or finance. Measure S does the opposite. It takes that out. And essentially it gives the district the power to sign construction and finance contracts before we vote. So it really, Measure S is a measure that takes us much further down the road to a desalination project before we get to vote. One thing I want to comment on, too, is Santa Barbara's experience. They built their desalination plant. They ran it for about 3 months, and then they shut it down because it was too expensive and too energy intensive. And they ended up selling the components to Saudi Arabia. So desalination can work, but it is definitely water of last resort, and the environmental costs, financial costs, and so forth just make it completely implausible for consideration here in Marin County.
Peter, we thank you for the call, and Paul Heliker wants to respond. Yeah.
Yes, I'd just like to make sure that people are aware of what the differences are between the two measures. Measure S and Measure T say that before MMWD can move forward with financing, constructing a desalination plant, including the design of the plant, that it needs to be approved by the voters. So I'm afraid Peter is slightly incorrect there, that Measure S does not allow MMWD to move forward with contracts for construction. That has to be approved by the voters. And what Measure T specifies, and here's the language, actually, it says that the ordinance says that only if there's an affirmative vote may MMWD issue any bonds to construct a desalination facility or spend any other funds. So it's basically
up to the voters.
It's up to the voters to allow any further expenditure, including on planning and analysis.
Well, here's Catherine, who posted this comment on our website. When considering the San Francisco Bay as a source of the water that we use to drink, wash our food, our children, and ourselves, shouldn't we follow the precautionary principle to reject that option which risks harm? For example, think of the suffering and loss of money we would have avoided if we had followed the precautionary principle years ago regarding lead in paint. Shouldn't we be putting our money into the water options that need less money and energy, produce less pollution and harm to the bay and risks to people? Measure T assures that more money will be available for those options that prevent our ever needing desal. Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go next to a caller joining us from Redwood City, and that's you, Katie. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I wanted to bring it back to the environmental impact. One of your guests said that anything was going to be low intake, and so any animals could swim away. But what about plankton? Has there been any studies on plankton, particularly phytoplankton that's plants, and they can't swim away, and a lot of the ocean creatures rely on plankton? I'll take my response off the air.
Okay, thank you for that call. Paul Rogers, what do we know about plankton and desal?
Well, that may be better suited for Paul Heliker there, because he's looked at the studies on his own plant, and every plant is different. It depends where you put it. So, for example, the one that I've been mentioning, the Bay Area Regional Desalination Project that the five biggest agencies are looking at right now, they studied three areas. One was on Ocean Beach, one was on the eastern edge of the Bay Bridge, and one was in Sassoon Bay up near Pittsburgh. And, you know, that you get different water qualities, different biota, different amounts of salinity, depending on where you go. I would generally say, as a general rule, that you know, there's a lot of plankton in the ocean, and the amount of water that you're talking about taking out, even compared to other uses, is minuscule, and I wouldn't expect that it would be relevant at all. But I'll leave that to the people who've studied the environmental impact reports on these.
Well, Heather Cooley wants to come in here. Go ahead, Heather.
Well, early in their show, we talked a lot about the brine discharge, but there are also environmental impacts associated with the intake. Larger organisms, fish, can be killed on the intake screens. That's referred to as impingement. Smaller larvae, plankton, can be sucked into the plant and killed mm-hmm. during the desalination process. That's referred to as impingement, or excuse me, as entrainment. And the impacts relative to kind of a to the environment are very much going to be site specific. In areas where there are a lot of a lot of sea life, the potential impacts can be large. And so it's hard to say overall if one particular plant is going to have a large impact or a small impact. It's really site specific. That being said, there haven't been a lot of studies done on the existing plants on the environmental impacts. Many of these plants were built before environmental impacts were of concern and in areas where there isn't a lot of concern about the environment overall. So we don't know. We don't have great operating data, although some of the later plants, the Tampa Bay plant and the Australia plants, are implementing environmental monitoring programs. And so we are starting to have better information.
You want to say something, Paul Heliker?
I just wanted to add in that we did look at that issue. We did a year-long study of what was in the water that would be brought into a desalination plant and looked at what the organisms were and found that by far the largest concentration was herring roe. We have a large herring population in the bay, and any time they spawn, that's the predominance of the organisms that you'd find in the bay. So we analyzed that. We looked at the other organisms that were in the water and used three different techniques to analyze what the impact might be on the bay ecosystem. And each one of those techniques indicated that the number of organisms we would bring into the plant that would be killed would be so small compared to the overall population in the bay that the effect would be insignificant. And they would be filtered out before it got to the reverse osmosis system. And to take issue with what Adam said earlier about toxic sludge, the material that would be filtered before it got to the reverse osmosis system would be algae, it would be silt, it would be some of these microorganisms, and it would all be what's naturally occurring in the bay. And that would be taken to a landfill. We tested it. It's not toxic. It's just organic material that they would actually use to cover the other material in the landfill. So that's one impact that we identified was insignificant as well.
Do you have a concern about this report's veracity, Adam Scow?
Well, I think this is we know that this is an area of ecological restoration in San Francisco Bay. The Romberg Center at San Francisco State is looking at reinstating eelgrass, an important source of marine life habitat. We're seeing oyster bed restoration, 300,000 native oysters in that area. And we think that those impacts have been poorly analyzed up to this point. And that's a shame because the Water District has been studying desalination for 20 years. They've spent millions of dollars on it. And we should have better information about that before proceeding.
Well, here's a listener. This is inevitable to get these kind of emails. I'm glad the subject is being addressed this morning on forum, but I wish it had been a week or more sooner because I already mailed my absentee ballot. We do our best in terms of timing. It doesn't always work. William from Belvedere, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I am one of the people who wrote Measure T, and therefore I'm particularly troubled by the fact that Mr. Heliker has distorted the limitations that he contends are in Measure T. Measure T specifically and only differs from Measure S in that Measure T prevents expenditures specifically, and we made this wording for that reason, expenditures for engineering or planning, in addition to construction without having a public vote. Measure S allows expenses for engineering and planning the plant as well as permits. And we don't feel that those expenditures should be undertaken without a vote of the public.
All right, let me get a response from David Heliker. Paul Heliker, excuse me.
Well, I think that's indicative of the challenge that the MMWD board faced when it was presented with Measure T from the petition gatherers. We had conflicting comments, even from Dr. Rothman himself, as to what Measure T would prevent or would allow. So that's the reason that the board decided to put Measure S forward on the ballot, because if the issue was that people wanted to vote before a desal plant were built or financed, then Measure S allows that. And it's similar to other votes that have happened in the past on a Russian River pipeline, a reservoir at Suluhuli. So that seemed to be the fundamental issue, and the board said, okay, let's give voters a clear choice. We won't ask them to make a decision about a confusing alternative, Measure T, which we didn't really know exactly what it did or didn't do. Whereas Measure S is very clear. It says that the board has to get voter approval before building or financing a desalination plant. And analysis and planning that would be necessary to tell the voters what a desalination plant would be consisting of would be allowed to happen. And the estimate is that that's somewhere around $500,000 to $700,000 worth of expense that might have to happen before it went to a vote.
Adam Scott.
Well, let me take a step back and talk about why we did Measure T. Measure T was put on the ballot because it seemed as if the public would not have the right to vote on this project, and that the Water Board is trying to slide this past the voters, where Marin County people have always had the right to vote on major water supply projects. So that's why Measure T was brought forward in the first place. We are concerned that Measure S has a big loophole, which allows all this money to be spent on permitting, designing, engineering the plant up until the very last moment, right before construction, to get the plant so pregnant, so to speak, that it has to give birth. We think that's an imprudent use of ratepayer funds. Let's have the vote before spending all the money on permitting, designing, and engineering, because the voters may well reject it. So why waste all that money now when we should have the vote sooner?
All right, here's a listener, Jim from San Francisco, says, for the last 30 years, California has implemented energy efficiency programs largely through the electric utilities that have successfully limited the growth in electric demand. Desalinization is one of the most electric-intensive industries. There is probably enough power available off-peak during low-usage hours at night to supply these plants, but most believe any additional electric capacity should be reserved for charging electric cars, which will be one of the largest growing demands for electricity. Renewables probably provide no potential for desalinization, owing to the fact that they rarely generate electricity off-peak at night. Better would be to follow the experience of energy efficiency programs that have been very successful in reducing demand through new, more efficient technologies.
Well,
it's Paul Hellicker.
That, of course, is our first choice, is to promote conservation. The desalination facility that we were looking at, and if we did one in the future, we would power it with renewable power. There is enough power in the renewable power grid in California to be able to supply a desalination plant, as well as our existing use of electricity. And that's Marin Municipal Water District's goal, is to reduce its carbon footprint, use renewable power, and have desalination be a green technology if it ever needs to happen. One last thing about the vote. No matter what happens with Measure S and Measure T, the Marin Municipal Water District has already adopted an ordinance that says that the voters will get to choose before a desalination plant is built. And that ordinance was adopted in August. It's on the books. So no matter what happens with S and T, that's the case.
Let me get Paul on. Thanks for waiting, Paul. Join us. You're on.
Hello. What we're basically talking about is supplying people with fresh water. And in India, they've been using a method of individual freshwater sources for over 5,000 years, which I don't hear mentioned, so I thought I would bring it up because I use it. And it's used by the astronauts in space, and it was used by the miners trapped in the mine in Chile. And that's obvious. What I'm talking about, I guess, is that I have been recycling my own urine each day for 27 years, and it's one of the best-known ways to prevent cancer and malaria. So it also recycles water, so in an emergency like an earthquake, people have individual supply of fresh water.
Well, it's done. Certainly, we had Mary Roach on, talked about NASA trips to Mars and everything. A little off the grid here in terms of our discussion, but thank you for that. Here's Richard in Carson City, who says, a nuclear aircraft carrier desalinates 400,000 gallons of water per day. Why couldn't water be desalinated commercially on the high seas and carried by barge to areas that need it? Interesting thought. Another listener, Christine, writes, one of your guests mentioned that desalination plants are essentially inevitable. It's not a matter of if, but when. I don't really understand why this has to be true. How far can conservation take us? What if we use rain catchments for lawn watering or simply increase the price of water to reflect its true cost? Has anyone done a study on that? It just doesn't make sense to me that we inevitably will have to choose an unsustainable option. If that were true, then it seems like there's little hope for the human race. And another listener says, did I hear correctly that Marin consumers are currently penalized for conserving water? Please elaborate and explain this craziness.
Well, I wouldn't say that they're being penalized. I think we've seen around the state that water use has dropped and utilities have costs that they have to cover. So you've seen the costs go up. The rates have gone up. And that's they've actually gone up much further in many other places than they have in Marin. So that's a fundamental problem that we have in trying to balance our revenues and expenses. And it's not unique to water utilities. It's true for any other type of utility that's trying to supply a good to members of the public while making sure that they can maintain the costs in their system.
Well, we'll find out after Tuesday what Marin voters decide on S&T. Again, if you want to read the impartial report that was put out by the Pacific Institute, you can simply go to their website at www.pacinst. That's pacinst.org. I want to thank Heather Cooley from the Pacific Institute for joining us this hour, and thanks to Adam Scow, also with us in studio, California Campaign Director for Food and Water Watch. And thank you, Paul Heliker, General Manager of the Marin Municipal Water District. And our thanks also to Paul Rogers, who was with us this morning from Scotts Valley by phone, environmental reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and our managing editor of Quest here at KQED, the Science and Environment series. Thanks to you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and we appreciate your listenership. We're here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And up ahead, we're going to talk about money and politics, who gets money from where, and, well, not only candidates, but propositions. We'll try to break all that down for you in the hour ahead. Hope you will join us for that. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.